This is a special podcast version of two Art of the Year interviews with Alan Harrison, the 501c3 guru, about his two books, Scene Change and Scene Change 2. Art of the Year is hosted by Larry Breckner and Esther Golden and is heard weekly on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM every Sunday at 7 p.m. Central Time and is widely available as a podcast from Lakeshore's website, NPR, Spotify, TuneIn, and many more. We'll start with our first interview with Alan on January 14th on Lakeshore Public Media, then move on to our next interview on December 29th, also on Lakeshore.
We would like to welcome Alan Harrison to Art on the Air. Alan is an author, speaker, writer, father, performer, nonprofit executive, and artist. For over 30 years, he led, produced, directed, promoted, raised money for over 300 theatrical productions on and off Broadway. Alan is currently a regular contributor for Arts Journal. He is also a two-time Jeopardy champion. Scene Change is his first full-length business release. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Alan. It's really
Aloha.
Nice to meet you.
Aloha and mahalo nui. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're so glad to have you join us and give us something that's a new perspective for, I think, a lot of our listeners, especially because they're involved in non-profit workers, artists, and arts organizations. So, Alan, first of all, we want to know about you. And I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you're now. So tell us all about Alan.
Well, I started as a performer way back when. And the story I love to tell people is that I started in a generation where a new theater had opened up in my hometown. They took an old movie theater that hadn't actually been used for years, and a live theater company took it over and had to renovate and rebuild. And they were also teaching classes at night. And when I was 16, I went into that place and said, I want to take classes. I knew my parents wouldn't back me on this because they thought we needed another lawyer in the world. And But I said, what can I do to help? And they said, well, you know, the seats haven't been scraped for gum and such for probably 15, 20 years. If you could take care of that, you know, and they thought I would just start and probably do one and then walk away being a 16-year-old. But I did all of them down there on my back with the scraper and the solvent, and it was what was needed to be done. So I did it and I said, okay, that's done. When's my first class? And they said that they kept giving me odd jobs here and there. And ultimately, I got hooked on theater through the performance, but I also started to understand what it took to put on a production. And that was important. So then I went from college, I went to New York, where I performed for a few years, and then ended up working for Lincoln Center Theater. In marketing, because somebody called me and said, hey, we're starting this theater company up at Lincoln Center. This is the 80s. The building hasn't been used in 11 years. And I'm thinking, oh, that's a lot of seats to scrape.
That's a lot of gum.
But hey, we're doing this thing. And so we ultimately were about a $25 million theater back in the 80s, 17 Tonys later. And then I left to go back to California. And then I've ping-ponged since then, Pittsburgh Public Theater, which is a terrific place. And then I was sort of headhunted for Seattle Rep, which is the first time I moved to Seattle. After a brief stop in Northern California, I ended up running the Alabama Shakespeare Festival in Montgomery, Alabama. I like to tell people that Mark Twain said that to live a full life, you have to live 3 years in a foreign country where they don't speak your language. And I feel like now I've had a full life. After my contract was up, I sprinted back to Seattle and have been here since.
Early in your life, was there plays that you were interested in? You obviously were scraping seats, but you said you learned a lot in the process there. But what did you learn? And before you went off to New York and all these other things, like in your young life, like what are the things you observed that later on became an impact on your life?
Well, one of the things I observed, and this is as a working actor, I did work a lot in those first 4 years in New York because I could sing well. I think that was really the only reason. That, and I was darn cute back then. But I think what I learned most of all at the time was that the creative process for the actor is very internal, but the creative process for the producer is not only internal, but you can see an impact right away. the creative process for the actor gets shunted at some point when somebody says, no, you have to do this. You have to cross to that side of the stage. Why? Because you won't get paid if you don't. You know, that becomes the thing. So that's why I went into producing. I produced two off-Broadway shows that, oddly, one was roundly panned, and it lasted 9 months. And the other one got great reviews and lasted 6 weeks. So go figure. And then I went to, you know, Seattle, and I knew that I was ultimately going to run a theater company. After all of the theater companies, and I ran Arts West in Seattle. That was my last executive directorship. And we turned it into a theater that actually meant something in the community by changing the mission and changing the point was that it was what was the community asking for, not what were we vain people doing. That gave me a lot of insight into how a good theater has to start to run. But even then, I didn't get the whole process. After that, I went into consulting, saw that nonprofit arts organizations were being too often led by artistic visionaries rather than the community telling them what to do. And then I would, you know, I'd ask around the communities and say, so what are your big issues? And they'd say, well, we got a big homeless problem, or we got a big we have food insecurity, we have kids who can't read, we have whatever we have. And I thought, you know, an arts organization is a nonprofit. And I went back to Section 501c3 of the IRS code. And guess what, folks? The arts are not a tax-exempt activity, according to the IRS. They don't even fall into, they have a miscellaneous bucket they call charitable activities. And it's not there either. And actually, it's not a bad thing that it's not there. Otherwise, Disney could be a nonprofit. So I said, well, then the object of the game is to do something that helps people, not that serves the art. And over time, as I started writing my blogs about 11 years ago, and then now this book, it's become clear, as crystal clear, that all other nonprofit organizations and charities either serve people or a few of them serve animals. But the rest of them, the arts organizations, always talk about serving the art. Well, the art doesn't need to be served. Art exists. Art is essential. Art exists whether we want it to or not, in the literal meaning of essential. Arts organizations are not essential. So to exist, you have to do something, not just do art.
Yeah, I like that phrase that you said, produce impact instead of producing art.
That's important, because how do you measure success unless you measure the impact? And if you can't measure something, I hear a lot of people in the arts world, when I talk to them or consult with their companies, they say, well, I can't measure the impact of my audience. I said, well, then it doesn't exist. You have to find a way to do it. And sometimes it means working with another nonprofit organization and contributing to that. One of my favorite stories is about this orchestra that I know that has ceased producing, not entirely, but has ceased producing most of its public concerts. It's down to just three or four in a hall. They still do, like a lot of orchestras do that have a big park nearby, they still do that in the summer for a couple of weeks, and really popular stuff because it's free. And then the rest of the time, they're splitting up into eights and 16s and groups and quartets sometimes. And they're going to tent cities and homeless camps. And they're going to, the story I heard was the one that where they brought a brass octet to an underpass. And they recognized that it had to be brass because underpasses are really loud. Right. So they went there and they brought out for the people who were living there, for the people in the tents there, and you know, in those blue tarps that were everywhere. And they all came out. They brought them chairs to sit on. They invited them out. They said, come on, we're doing a concert for you. Come on. Come on out. So they did the concert for them. And that was a first step for them, for the people who needed it, toward a moment of dignity that they weren't getting otherwise. There, you know, somebody knew they were there. And then that wasn't it. They brought social service people with them. So people would sit next to them during the concert and say, hey, do you need a place to shower? Do you need a place to shave? Do you need a place to get some new clothes? Would you like to sign up for Section 8 housing? Is there something I can do for you? And something like 20% of that particular group ended up in Section 8 housing. So, And I'm sure that once you have a house, once you have a place to live, and yes, there are mental health issues involved as well, but once you have a place to live, that solves a lot of things. That just solves a lot of things. You're dry, you're clean, there's a bathroom. You know, these are things that don't exist out under an overpass. So some of them went back to work. So now they're contributing back to society, and all because ultimately the orchestra had a ton to do with that. So that's a nonprofit arts organization that is doing impact, kept the data going and understood what they were doing. And then they received funding from their city from something like $3 million based on that one story.
I guess the recommendation, and you know, in your book, which I strongly recommend actually to nonprofits, board members, executive directors, even patrons, so to speak, but how do they make that transition to finding that? I mean, I know each community is different, but let's take an art gallery, and how do they do that? Or what do they look for?
You got to talk, first of all. You have to talk and listen. So you have to find all of your community leaders. And I don't care if they're not arts people. Start with the obvious ones, like, I don't know, your mayor. But go beyond that and go to the people who are leading the community and ask them, what do you need? Rather than give me money, which is usually what they're saying. What can I do to get money? It's a different question. It's what do you need? How can I help you? What are your biggest wants and needs? You also have to have the want to. If you don't have the want to, which is I want to help my community rather than just stand here and you know, open my art gallery and not understand why people aren't coming in, then you'll succeed. It's more than just having, it's important to have artists, you know, using your lenses, your prism of diversity, equity, and inclusion to get art into the studio that perhaps speaks more to your community from the art standpoint, but you have to take the next step and actually go into the community and say, how can I help solve or mitigate your problems? And let's say your problem is that there's a huge anti-LGBT neighborhood in which your art gallery exists. You can either, and you don't like that. You think that's a bad idea. Because if you don't think that's a bad idea, then why would you help? So let's say you want to help them. You want to help the community be more tolerant, be more accepting. If you just do gallery presentations with gay artists, that's not going to do it. That's just going to speak to the gay artists in town because they're the ones who might come. What you want to do is go out into the community and say, and find ways to work on boards, work on gay legislation, work on anti-gay activities that are out there, talk to the community people involved, see what they need. They probably have better ideas on how to fix it than you do. But if you're there as a team member, you start to become indispensable to your community. And once you're indispensable, you're gold. You're not going anywhere. You're going to be fine. Too often, and I think the pandemic sped things up a bit on this, but arts funding has been dropping for years and years before the pandemic hit. I mean, the pandemic just rushed things along. The reason was that the arguments that are made to support the arts in America do not land. There have been three arguments they've used for a half a century now. And the arguments are butts in seats. Look how many people come. Well, butts in seats is not a metric. If it were, the Yankees would be a nonprofit organization. And in fact, if you look at the work they do in the community, you might think they're a better nonprofit organization. So that's one. So that leg is broken. The second leg is positive economic impact. This is where they talk about how, because arts patrons, especially performing arts patrons, spend $20 on top of their ticket price. And so on dinner and babysitters and parking and whatever, the average is 20. Well, it's a useless number, really, because if that were a nonprofit metric, then restaurants could claim to be nonprofit, because people who buy dinner also go shopping, and they also pay babysitters, and they also pay for parking, and sometimes they pay for a ticket for your orchestra, you know? So that's a broken leg. It's a bad argument. The third argument is a little bit more intricate, and that is that national studies have shown that students' test scores have gone up from the experience with music and with art. And that may well be true. The problem is that national data is useless for a local arts organization. My question to the arts organization is always, so what did your students do? What did your patrons do? Did you give tests to the audience before and after they saw the show? What did you do? How can you prove that? If you can prove that, great. But if you can't, and if you're just relying on some national study, it's totally irrelevant to what you're doing. And also, is that your point? Is that your mission, to improve test scores in the community? Because if it were, that's a reasonably good mission. But if your mission is, we do art for art's sake, and oh, by the way, our ancillary effect is this, it's a byproduct, then no, that's not a good leg to stand on. So you got three-legged stool and all three legs are broken. It's time, and the public knows that. So during the pandemic, we actually gave a word, essential, to activities that are being done. We said that there were nonprofits that were essential. There were food banks and homeless shelters. And we even used the word essential for commercial organizations like supermarkets and delivery services. But the arts were, as arts organizations, were deemed by the public not to be essential. Just because you yell, hey, we're essential too, doesn't make you essential. So as such, now you have to go out and be essential by doing the work to help your community be better. What will suffer in this case? Well, your artist's vision may suffer in the sense that you don't get to do everything you want to do. If that's what you want to do as an organization, take the nonprofit status away, go be for profit, get investors. There's no moral high ground to the nonprofit status. There isn't. Just go be a commercial organization. Then your goal is money, and you get to do whatever you want to gain the money. But if you're going to take money from me by being a nonprofit, and when I say that, I'm using that literally, if you're not paying taxes, guess who is?
Right.
I am, you are, everyone is paying for you to be here. Then you have to be responsible to the owner of the company, and that's the community, not you.
One thing you talked about were donors and, well, also toxic donors. And tell us a little bit about that process. I mean, I think we've all dealt with naming rights and things like that, but yeah.
In the arts are probably the only section of the nonprofit universe. And when I say that, I mean all charities. And yes, the arts are a charity. It's where the only one where the donors donate so the donors may attend. It's like it would be ridiculous to think of a food bank that way. You know, a food person is asked to pay to go to the food bank, and then when they're in the food bank, they're also solicited for more money, and then they pay for the groceries. That's not how food banks work. That's how arts organizations work. So as a result, you have a whole bunch of, you know, most donors, 99% of them are terrific. But the 1% that aren't are just screwing it up for all of us. And it's the Sackler family who polluted a whole bunch of arts fields and killed, 450,000 people with oxycodone. Yeah, you know what? They were arts washing their name. they should, that toxicity extends to you. If you have the Sackler family gallery, still, that says more about you than about them. They're already poisoned. Would you have the Adolf Hitler Theater Center if somebody gave you enough money? I don't think so.
Yeah, so donors are an issue that they all have to deal with. Well, you know, we only have a few minutes left, and you told us some of the recommendations you had for not-for-profits that they need to think of themselves as a charity or not. But tell us how your book addresses that and your lectures and things like that and why that's important for them to pick that up and read it.
Well, the book Scene Change, which is out in the United States on February 1st, but it's available for pre-order at all places where you can buy books, including, and I always recommend, your local independent bookstore. Just tell them, I want Scene Change by Alan Harrison, or just Scene Change. It should pop up on their screens. But it'll be actually physically available in bookstores on the 1st, and yeah, Amazon and Barnes & Noble too. But the first part of the book, I try to lay out the idea that may be foreign to these nonprofit arts organization people, which is that you are in fact a charity, and that takes a lot of persuasion involved. If you don't think you're a charity, if you think you're if you've made up a word to try to cover it, like you're non-commercial, non-commercial is not a word. It's used in public radio, I know, and it's used in public television, and that is because there is such a thing as commercial television. So that it gives a back and forth. But non-commercial really isn't a term of law. It's not it's just a made up word. And it allows people to think that they're not charities. They are charities. You're a charity just as much as the Red Cross or the Doula Society. So that lays it out. And then the last several chapters, which I hope people will not skip to, because you won't understand why those things are ideas and important, are ideas on how to make things better. They are ways in which you can make things better for your organization and for your community. Don't skip to that part first. Mm-hmm. You won't understand it unless you read the first part. It's a funny book. It's very conversational. It's a very quick read. And Larry liked it.
I sure did. It is a very quick read, and it, like I said, I really think that the arts organizations I'm involved with, I'm going to make sure they get that book, because I think it's important for them to see that in your perspective. That's Alan Harrison, and you can see his book, Scene Change, Why Today's Nonprofit Arts Organizations Have to Stop Producing and Start Producing Impact. Find him online. And Alan, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your nonprofit vision and how it really should be.
I'm happy to be here, Larry and Esther. And
thank you.
Aloha to you.
Mahalo for the conversation.
We hope you enjoyed that first interview. Now we'll move on to Alan's newest book, targeted at non-for-profit boards, with his December 9th interview.
We are happy to welcome back Alan Harrison to Art on the Air. Alan is a writer and speaker specializing in nonprofit arts organizations, strategy, and life politics. His blog posts appear regularly in major publications, including Arts Journal. For 30 years, he has explored the relationships between the arts and community on behalf of nonprofit arts organizations across the United States. Previously, we spoke about his book, Scene Change, Why Today's Nonprofit Arts Organizations Have to Stop Producing Art and Start Producing Impact. Today, we are here to discuss his new book, Scene Change 2, The Five Real Responsibilities of Nonprofit Arts Boards. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Alan. It's very nice to see you again.
Aloha. Mahalo for having me.
Aloha.
Well, Alan, we're so great to have you back on and with the release of your new book. And I know Esther and I both enjoyed it. In fact, we talked off air about some of the impacts it has on boards that we have served on. And I see some things, but just briefly, I mean, people can go back to our January 12th or 14th on Lakeshore to hear your previous interview with us. But maybe just to recap briefly your biography, which I find very fascinating, some of the things, and then we'll get into the new book.
Well, I've worked for 30, again, Esther mentioned it, about 30 years in the nonprofit arts industry in various roles. I marketed, I was a development director, I was an executive director for 15 years. I was a managing director at a partnership, a lot of things like that. And never forget, I was on Jeopardy in 2019.
Right.
And,
oh,
yeah. And I was a champion, so I won twice. But no, seriously, I've been working with these groups for years. I always thought there was something nagging and wrong. And over the last dozen years or so, what I've really noticed happening, and there are consequences because of it, of turning into arts organizations closing down, is that they're really, most arts organizations, I wish I could say, you know, most arts organizations didn't do this, but actually they do this kind of art for art's sake mission, which really has nothing to do with the community they're serving. They're rushing, as I put it somewhere in the book, into an elitist whirlpool of irrelevance. And that is because, or one of the outcomes of that is that donors are donating to arts organizations so that donors may attend. So if the donor is the beneficiary, that is the textbook definition of elitism. And so that has to stop in order for the nonprofit arts organizations to prove any kind of essential quality to their communities. There are some, happily, wonderful arts organizations that do use the community's needs as their starting point. And they talk to the people within their community and say, what do you need? Never what do you want, just what do you need? And they say, and then they use the arts as somehow a tool to make that happen. The perfect example is the Louisville Orchestra in Louisville, Kentucky, which is not very far from you. And they only do 17 performances in their great big scary Whitney Hall. And I say scary because a lot of these buildings are built to look somewhat like prisons. only 17, that's it for the year. But they do 250 performances around the state of Kentucky in every county in the state. And they never charge for those tickets. They perform in high school gyms, in libraries, in rec centers, outside. They played at Mammoth Cave with Yo-Yo Ma. It's quite an experience to see the people, and they play Kentucky's music for Kentuckians. Mm-hmm. So they'll not only play the classical canon, but they'll also bring in, say, a bluegrass band from Kentucky, or a jazz band or a combo or something. And they'll play together so that you have jazz with a full orchestra, a Grammy Award-winning orchestra right behind them. It's quite the experience. At these concerts, you don't have people sitting back in their seats and clapping politely. You have people standing and dancing in the aisle. Yes. But beyond that, they're bridging the divide between the urban and the rural populations of Kentucky, which have been at odds with each other for years and years and years. And they all come together and they all learn what they're about through the music. The music brings them together to begin with, and then they start the discussions about making a better life. So that's what arts organizations are supposed to be doing, that kind of thing.
What you just said, Alan, makes me think that that community is actually listening to what the community is saying, because bland experiences are not inspiring. And so if they are doing things that are interesting, then they're going to get the engagement for the people they want to have the works presented in front of.
That's right. And it's exactly right. And it makes them excited to be there. And they're dressed.
Right.
And
involved.
One performance I went to, I embedded with them for about a month. And one performance I went to was in a rural high school with a domed gym, the worst possible acoustics for an orchestra, hard surfaces everywhere. And I'm telling you, these people, they look like they just came off the job. I mean, I saw men and women with blue denim chambray work shirts with mud on them. So, I mean, I know they just got off work, and they bring their families, and they came, and the families may be dressed in their Sunday best, but they're all jumping around and dancing. The old ones, the young ones, they're clog dancing to the music. It's something you would never see at another kind of orchestra concert. And the music is brilliant. It is, as I say, they won the Grammy Award last year. So it behooves the people it just gives them a little bit of push that say, okay, this is not just a local orchestra. Oh, there's nothing wrong with a local orchestra. This is actually a national mover on the scene.
But if you ask them about it, if you ask the Louisville Orchestra, Teddy Abrams, the conductor, and Graham Parker, the executive, if you ask them both why they're doing this, they'll say, we're doing this for them. We're not doing this for us.
In your first book, you had a great example, and I don't know if that was Louisville or some other orchestra, that they were, you know, looking at their funding, and then they went out into the community and played like for homeless people, but they also brought social services. Maybe expand on that again. I found that a fascinating example.
It was a great program. I have to tell you, the orchestra is kaput, but It doesn't matter. They did the right thing when they were alive. Closing down is not a, there's no value judgment to that. As somebody once told me, you know, every Broadway show that has ever opened has closed, right, except for the ones that happen to be running right now.
Yeah.
And, or if you look at it in more of a macro thing, every 99.9% of the animals that have ever existed on the planet Earth are extinct. The rest are alive right now. So there's no shame in closing down as long as you're doing the right work while you're open. While they were open, one of the programs they did was they went to underpasses, into tent cities and homeless communities. They brought either an octet or 16. It wasn't ever more than that. Usually a lot of brass and a lot of microphones at work there, because it's really loud under an overpass. And they would perform for the homeless people, the unhoused people under those overpasses, by bringing chairs. They brought bottles of water for everybody. They had social service entities with them who sat among them and coaxed them out of the tents, because there's a trust issue, and they played for them. And at the break, the same social service people were saying, now, what do you need? Do you need a new set of clothes? Do you need a haircut, a shave? What is it that you want? Do you want to take a shower? I can hook you up with all of those things. Do you need to fill out paperwork for Section 8 housing? Something like that. And the results were amazing, is that normally in an unhoused camp like that, maybe 5% will find housing ultimately. This group, it was 20%. And the old saw that some people still stick to, and I really, it's about the worst, again, elitist thing to say, is that, oh, these people don't want to find homes. They want to be homeless. Nobody wants to be homeless. Not one person wants to be homeless. Get that out of your head right now. It's not true. I don't know who's telling you this, but they're wrong. So in this case, here they are. They're doing good works for the community. They're using music as the play, as the way to bring them out of the tents. And then suddenly they're, you know, they've got apartments, and they may be going back to work, and then contributing taxes back to the community. And it becomes a virtual cycle that was remarkable. I hope somebody else picks it up. It was in the Bay Area.
Right. Now, in your first book, and then we'll get on to your second book, it kind of like teed up, I think, the issues. I mean, it really did that. So identify some of the things that are in your first book, because these books are connected. You really, you know, I mean, they both stand alone. I mean, you could pick up your new book and it will stand alone fine. But the first book really clearly identifies some of the issues. But maybe go over those once again for our audience.
Well, Scene Change laid out the problem, and it lays out this toxicity problem, this irrelevance problem, this idea that nonprofit arts organizations have never read the IRS statute for nonprofit organizations. It's called 501c3 because that's the statute in the IRS code, section 501, subsection 3, subsection C, subsection 3. And it's really short. It's like four sentences. It's nothing. And yet, every time I speak to a group of nonprofit arts leaders, and I do it often, that's the first question I give them. How many of you have ever read section 501c3 of the IRS code? And at most, it's 10%. And it just infuriates me because, well, I don't know, if you were sending a balloon up in the air, wouldn't you want to know how the thing works before you climb into the basket? The arts are never mentioned in Section 501c3 as a tax-exempt activity, and that is not an oversight. It's on purpose. The reason it's not is because art by itself has been deemed, art is essential, artists are magical because they can take disparate things and put together art. Arts organizations are neither essential nor magical. Art and artists will exist before they existed before there were nonprofit arts organizations, and they'll exist after all of them have closed down. The point is that for a nonprofit arts organization to become indispensable, it has a duty. It has signed a document that says we are responsive to the community, not to the art. We use art as a tool to make life better. They've actually signed paperwork that says that, or else they wouldn't have gotten the 501c3 in the first place. Once they get the 501c3, the truth is the IRS is never going to come after them and say, you know, you're not doing your duty, because they don't have enough people. But that's not the reason to do unethical work. That's just a way to get around. And very rarely, and it takes a lot of effort to close down a nonprofit organization of any kind for not doing its work. The one that comes to mind is a foundation, a family foundation that was in New York that was clearly not doing anything for its communities and in fact was pocketing the money, which is one of the first rules. You can't accept any of the money. And that was, what was the name of that foundation again? It was run by this this orange-faced guy that foundation. And so they actually closed down. But do you know how much money and how many court dates it took for that to happen, even though they were blatantly messing up and blatantly profiting from their own foundation? It took years. So imagine that they're not going to come after a little nonprofit arts organization if it's not doing the work. That said, if you're not doing the work, you shouldn't be a nonprofit arts organization. Go ahead and be a commercial one, is what I've said right in both books. There's no shame in it. In fact, there's no moral high ground to running a nonprofit. There are just different responsibilities attached. And it's easy to start a for-profit arts organization. People do it all the time. And I don't just mean Broadway or something like that. Small companies. There's a company that I was talking to in Philadelphia, for-profit, because it allows them to really concentrate on their art. If people want to buy the art, that's great. If they don't, oh well, that's what they're measuring their progress on, not how good people's lives get.
Alan, were you piggyback writing? I can see you writing Scene Change with your left hand and Scene Change 2 with your right hand at the same time.
Originally, I thought I would put the two ideas together into one book. And when I put it out there, there were two things that happened. One, it was incredibly long. And then the second part is that I noticed that there weren't any books on board members, and I wanted to do more research on board members before I wanted them to get this book. There are really very few books on how to be a board member for an arts organization. It's me and Michael Kaiser and a little bit of Richard Ingram. Richard Ingram wrote a really good book called 10 Important Responsibilities for Nonprofit Board Members, all kinds of nonprofits. And it's a very dry but accurate depiction of the very specific responsibilities of boards, not arts boards, because the assumption in Richard Ingram's book is that you're in a nonprofit organization because there was a need in your community and you're trying to solve or mitigate the problems. The issue with the arts organizations is that there is no, for the most part, there are no such people who are doing it. There are some who are doing great work. And you know what? As I write about this in Arts Journal every week, the letters I get, the people who think I'm coming down on them for not doing it, they're the ones almost every time who are said, well, why are you complaining about that? I mean, look what I do. My organization helps, you know, feed people in this corner and helps clothe people over here. And we do, we serve as the in-house art, music and dance departments for our schools. And my response is, isn't it always the way that the one who's actually doing the work is the one who's feeling put upon? You're doing great work. You know, keep it up. But for the most part, no, that's not happening. And so it's my intention for board members to buy this book which has been, I hammerlocked the publisher to make this second book really affordable. It's under $12 a copy. And that's just the list price. There are even places where you can get it cheaper than that if you order a certain amount. But I really wanted people to buy 20 for their board or 10 for their board or 5 for their board. It was never my intention that, for example, in the first book or the second book, that these were textbooks. And yet I'm hearing from arts administration leaders, teachers, professors, and such, who are now using these books in their own classroom alongside the more dry books that are out there. This is what they're telling you to do, but this is what's really happening. Alan will tell you what's really happened. And because they're easy to read and they're kind of fun and funny in times and a little more self-revealing than I probably had intended, they needed to be two books. So hence Scene Change and Scene Change 2.
Most of us are asked to be on a board and we're just swimming in there not knowing what it actually means. You know, we might have done a piece of work that was interesting and then all of a sudden we're on an arts education board. And so this really, you know, it is a primer.
Well, yeah. Well, there are a couple of things, reasons why. I did a research project in between the two books where I sent I did a survey with 600 board members of nonprofit arts organizations who answered anyway. And I asked them, what's your most important responsibility to the organization? What's your board's single most important responsibility to the organization? And then what is the one responsibility that the board is currently lacking? And it was three questions, and I limited them to 6 words apiece so that they wouldn't go off on a, you know, on a story. And also so it was more easy to categorize. They have no idea why they're there. They mentioned fundraising and they mentioned governance. Fundraising to them, when I did some qualitative research later, turned into, well, they want me to write a check, which is, I mean, that's great, but that's not what fundraising is. And then governance, they just use the word because somebody told them.
Right.
It doesn't really mean anything to them. So I created this, and over the years, I've created a lot of rules for board meetings and such. One of the most important ones, and I write about it in here, is that if you know that you're spending a lot of money on a meeting, and in this case, if you took every board member and everyone who's sitting in your board meeting room and you decided just they were $100 an hour consultants, and if there were 20 people in there, that's $2,000 an hour that you're paying on consulting fees. They're in-kind donations, essentially, but that's still $2,000 an hour. If you're spending, let's say your meeting is 2 hours long, that's $4,000. Let's say you have 10 meetings a year, that's $40,000. Do you want to spend $40,000 talking about the past, things that are unchangeable, or do you want to talk about the future? So my sense is that if people took board meetings and only talked about the future, instead of rehashing an executive director's report, which is the purpose of which is to talk about what's going on and the past, let that sit by itself, then you'll be far more productive in the long run. And so I created some rules. Everybody follows Robert's Rules of Order. It was started by a military man. It is not it's a great way to stifle innovation and conversation. It's more than just guardrails on a conversation that can go out of hand. So I have my own set of rules in here, Harrison's Rules of Order, which I'll just say the first one, which is on this topic, which is don't waste the money you've budgeted for board meetings by talking about things you cannot change. So there are several other rules to follow, but they're all very much common sense ways to get your organization to stop concentrating on financial results as some sort of way to the future, but instead looking at your impact. For nonprofit organizations, all nonprofit organizations, including and perhaps especially the arts, the coin of the realm is not the money. Your financial bottom line is fine, but that is incidental. Your impact, as you measure it, is what you're measuring. It's not a for-profit company. It doesn't matter how much money you're making or losing, but I would rather have a company lose money and create a ton of impact than the other way around, to be running in the black And then, you know, but we really didn't do anything this year to help anybody. So, and I think that I'm not alone. The public wants this too. Your community wants this, and that's the key. Ask them for, you know, what's wrong, and then make it possible to help it. Help solve these and mitigate these issues.
Well, in our final minute, we want to let you have the opportunity to tell people when and how your book will be available, Scene Change 2, and also about how they can reach out to you for your blog and information and things like that.
Sure. So to contact me, and I hope you will, because, and people have not been shy about doing so. So do that. My email address, and I know it's silly, but it's Alan, A-L-A-N, at 501c3.guru, which is also 501c3.guru is my own personal website. But you can read my stuff every week on artsjournal.com, which is an incredible aggregate of arts organization, arts stories from around the world. And they've asked me to be a blogger every week. As far as the books are concerned, Scene Change is available now in every bookstore. Just ask for it. And if they don't have it, they'll order it for you. Scene Change 2 was made available on December 10th in the UK, December 17th in the US. So it's available as well. If you order it right now and get it, you know, get them both. If you haven't gotten the first, you really should get the first and then get the second. And that's not me trying to make money on it. I don't make money off of these books, but it will make much more sense to you if you get Scene Change and then Scene Change 2. And then pick up a whole bunch of Scene Change 2s for your board members because they don't know why they're there.
Right. Well, Alan, I appreciate that. Both books are really spoke to me, and being a board chair on Lakeshore Public Media, which is this station and some other boards. And I know Esther also has served on them. And there's some great advice there. And I agree. Scene Change, kind of tease it up. Scene Change 2 actually gives you some tools to work with the board. Alan, thank you so much for coming back on. That's Alan Harrison on the two Scene Change books.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks to Alan for sharing his passion about the non-for-profit world, and thank you for listening to this special podcast version of Art on the Air. Information about our show is available at breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA, including a complete show archive and information about being a guest on our show.